everybody. This is Armand DeMille. I'll be right back with you. Here we are, with you with the Positive Mind, WBAI 99.5 FM on your dial, bringing you ideas and considerations to help you lead a more positively minded life. In the studio with me today, Roberta Maria Atti. Hi, Roberta.
Hello, Armand.
We decided to take a look at Katrina from a different, well, maybe not such a different point of view. But from a different point of view. We want to look at shame. Yes, we want to talk about shame. We want to talk about the idea that that there's a certain amount of shame being discussed in the press, in all of the accounts. They talk about the United States shame, but we want to talk about shame in a little more detail. And I want to go back to some of the recent discoveries about shame and how it's broken down into legitimate shame and toxic shame.
Yes, Armand. This is the work of John Bradshaw, who wrote a book entitled Toxic Shame, I believe. And he differentiated shame in the two categories that you just named, one being the normal boundary-like experience of a human being that prevents us from going too far outside of our own limits, and that's the legitimate shame. And toxic shame is something entirely different. Toxic shame is toxic in the sense that it makes the person suffer a great deal, and it changes the chemistry of the body, it changes the biological structure and function of the body. Toxic shame is something that is handed over from one individual to another.
Usually a parent.
Usually a parent.
Parents or people in charge, it could be teachers.
Yes, usually it starts with a child being shamed by the adults or by older kids around him or her. And this shame is compared to a coat or to something that you wear that someone throws onto you, at you. And from that moment on, you wear it and you're not able to take it off. And it hurts and it's uncomfortable and it's painful.
Now, we talk about toxic shame because we're talking about what happened to many people who were involved in watching Katrina and watching the devastation down in New Orleans and watching the lack of response that we had, you know, as we were looking down, the lack of information that was accurately coming out. I mean, we have learned since Katrina that what was projected by the press was nothing compared to the real disaster that was going on, although the words were being said and the people were calling for help. But what happened to the people? What happened to the people who were there? What happened to the people who were in charge who didn't get help? And what happened to us as we watched? This is what we're going to look at today. Today we're going to look at shame and what the shame has done to us. And I'm going to talk first to beginning right from where you were, Roberta, that once toxic shame is there, once you feel it, once it's on you, there's a kind of an embarrassment, a tainting you feel about yourself. Now, I'm suggesting that those of us who have watched tragedy after tragedy and watched ourselves, watched things go on that we are passively a part of, I am claiming there is a shame that we feel. And that this shame goes inside of us somewhere. And we wear it like an embarrassment or a kind of a tainting of your skin. And the most important thing that happens to us when we are inactively or actively a part of neglecting a situation or watching a situation and doing nothing about it or judging it in some way, what happens to us is a kind of an emptiness. Your soul, in effect, leaves your body. Mm. I want to talk about the scope of the disaster as it was reported. At first, it was revealed that the poor became visible in the news in various forms, and then the major thing that was projected was the looters, the dangerous criminals that emerge when repressive states of control are removed. So that was one thing that we was seeing. And then there was a brewing public health problem that was in, as in the people in the Superdome. And of course there were people who were too stubborn to heed the advice of the authorities. So when we looked at the poor in this tragedy, we looked at them basically, or many people looked at them, and most of America looked at them as, oh, those poor, stupid folks. Mm-hmm. Look at what they've done. Look how low class they are. Look at them. And there was a kind of a pathos, but there was a wall between you and the feeling you had because you separated yourself from these people, almost as if, look at the mess they got themselves into by not leaving. We saw this tragedy as almost a class difficulty.
Sure, right, because it seemed, well, you know what, Armand, I think that those walls between people exist all the time, but in a disaster like that, when the poorest and the neediest are left to their own very limited resources, and when it becomes apparent that there is nothing in place to help them, the shame emerges out of the centuries and, you know, the years of accumulated lack of concern and lack of care and lack of human support. So I think that shame, which is the toxic shame by definition, is always there. But we don't feel it because we've become numbed to it. And we feel it when, in an occasion like this, like Katrina, it becomes, you know, impossible not to feel it anymore. It just emerges out of the depth of our being.
Strangely enough, in some of the psychological reports of the people who went through the disaster, there's a significant amount of shame for the people who suffered through the disaster as well. It's almost as if there is something wrong with me. That's why I was living in this condition. And then in addition, the fact that they were in the Superdome without having any bathroom facilities and stuff like that led to another kind of accountability. You know, they looked at themselves and they said, look at us, look at how, you know, shameful we are. Mm-hmm. And there was a feeling that actually went on. And many people went into one of three different routes. Different paths. We did, the watchers, and the people who were there. You could either become dead. What happens when you lose your soul? You go dead to everything around you. That's how many people protect themselves.
Right.
So you either go dead, or you can go to addiction. You can try to find a way out of it, or you can go to violence. Now, let's start off with, Roberta, the natural, what we called violence, the natural tendency of somebody in a disaster to, what's this phrase?
Sauve qui peut.
That sauve qui peut.
Those who can save themselves, go ahead. And it's the sentence that a captain would yell out in a sinking ship. And it means there is nothing you can hope for outside of your own capacity to save yourself.
So do anything you can do
to
survive. How do you say it in Italian?
Si salvi chi può.
And you know, it's funny. In English, we don't have such a phrase.
Hmm.
You know what I mean?
That is interesting. I never heard.
In English, we say ladies and children first. You know, well, wait a minute. Yet aren't we the ultimate sauve qui peut?
I like your accent, Armand.
Yeah. So what happened was the kind of people who were there went to either a deadness. Now, there's a natural tendency to go dead, especially in certain cultures, because if you've been beaten long enough and kept down long enough, and if you've been really poor, going dead is an easy solution. You just don't feel much.
Right.
And you try to feel as little as possible.
Sure, because all the tension of the repression puts that tension in your muscles, and it constricts the blood flow, and literally and physiologically you go numb. And you know, Armand, I have even heard at times, I can't remember the source, but someone inferring that New Orleans deserved a punishment for all the sin that was going on in that city. So New Orleans, in a way, was already a carrier of public and social shame, which is astounding, but unfortunately that's what happens.
So the deadness is one response that they could have and we could have. And this is the interesting thing on both sides of it. Those going through it became dead. But, you know, they weren't so dead. They were fighting for themselves. They were screaming at us, give us the help we deserve. How humiliating to be begging and screaming, give us help, and there is nobody there. Nobody's responding. Oh, yes, we'll send you some help. And then this thing that we perceived as a city breaking out in violence, and I remember seeing one news reporter from Channel 4 who said, we were in danger of our lives. We had to get out of there because the people would have grabbed our car. Mm-hmm. And he said, I had 20 packages, get this, of canned sausage that I kept in my car so that if they tried to steal my car, I was going to bargain my way out with 20 cans of canned sausages. Well, wait a minute. If you got 20 cans of canned sausages, why aren't you giving them out?
Oh,
what are you doing holding them in your car to bargain with? Hmm. So the violence, that which broke out, you know, the looting that happened, and sure, we see pictures of people stealing televisions.
Mm.
And they say, and we look down and we'll say, oh, look at those terrible people stealing televisions. What do they need televisions for? Well, it's anything you could barter for food.
Sure.
Anything you could use to barter with. You grab everything that's possible.
You know, Armand, the hurricane itself, isn't it symbolic of this force that just breaks through structures and breaks through normalcy and creates a situation where everything that's hidden, everything that's contained is now flooding out of the center of something. So the behaviors that you are describing are behaviors of despair that in a normal day they may be contained within a society, but they are already intrinsically existent there because the pain and misery has been going on for so long. It's just that when you release the structures, when you open up the floodgates, it all comes out, and there it is for us to see and look at and feel ashamed of. But, you know, I don't think it's the disaster that created that violence or that numbness or that that behavior. I think the behavior is normally contained by the protective structures, and then those are that which was missing at that time. But anyway, yes, it was a horrible experience to watch this going on and to feel so powerless.
We had watched 9/11, and then we watched a series of things that took place with our government in response. And I kind of wondered to myself, you know, if I were down there in New Orleans and I heard somebody say to me, and all I own is my house or a piece of my house or the stuff that's in the house that I'm renting, and then somebody comes along and says, the government comes along and says, get out, there's a chance you're going to lose everything, and you know if you leave your home, everything inside it could be stolen, it could be taken away. And you may not have much, you know, but what little you have, you protect. And who would believe the government anyway? Orange alert, orange alert, orange
mm-hmm.
alert.
Mm-hmm.
You know, oh, watch out, be careful. And then you say, wait a minute, you know, who would believe? It's little wonder that many people said, no, I'm not going to follow this.
Right.
I'm not going to go along with it. Numb. Now, when you get numb, there's an unfortunate thing, and it's a thing that many of the survivors are kind of dealing with, and especially the children of the survivors. You get apathy when you become numb. You become anhedonic, which means you have no source of pleasure. You feel like a zombie moving through life by rote.
Right.
Now, that is not just, again, not just the victims. That is those of us who took no part, who did nothing. And I'm having a kind of, I want to explain that there's no judgment about the people who did nothing. I want to explain that there are people who had psychological effects, and we all had a psychological reaction to what went on.
I think a lot of us felt that we couldn't do anything, because by the time we saw what was going on, what was really going on, which I doubted that we really saw the whole of it, but what could we have done? By that time, only emergency personnel was allowed into the scene, and besides, someone like myself, what kind of resources do I have that I can enter into a scenario like that and do something? You know what I mean? There's a powerlessness that goes with that shame.
But the powerlessness that goes with that shame, Roberta, I'm going to say, comes from more of a sense of having lived in this country for the last few years, and to feel that growing powerlessness that happens whenever the government gets involved.
Yes, I agree.
You know, there is certainly, you know, I knew a group of social workers who got on a bus and headed right down there to help out.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they said, we're going to be needed down there, and they just, boom, they just kind of went down to try to see what they could do. But there is something about the fact that it's in the government hands, and something has happened to us.
Right.
Something has happened to us. We have to figure this out. We have to figure out that 60% of the people who are currently, who are in the United States, disagree with our military actions in the Middle East. 60% of it. Therefore, 60% of us are observing, killing, and dying, and feel on some level a level of shame.
Yes.
60% of us are feeling this level of shame, if not more, of course. And so we're at the point where we have had to go further numb. And you could see that numbness has changed. That numbness has led to a growth in a number of things, which is violence and a number of medications. Now, I think the growth of Prozac, the explosive growth of all of those antidepressants, is happening as a result of our going numb. And I think the use of different drugs has kind of exploded, because addiction is a natural response to shame.
Yes, absolutely. Because, well, any time we use a substance to medicate toxic shame, for a period of time, we have an opportunity to have this feeling lifted, even though it's an illusion. The feeling is so painful day in and day out. And it's so, like Armand said, it empties us of our soul. It feels like we're being emptied out from the inside. And so an addiction to anything, to a substance or to a behavior, is a form of self-medicating against this shame that makes us feel numb or enraged, you know, at the circumstances that we don't feel we have the power to change. So I think that ultimately addiction is an illusion of control. And when I cannot control the circumstances outside, at least I can control how I feel about the circumstances on the inside. Well, it's a desperate act, and it's a desperate behavior, but you know, we do know that as a result of Katrina and other disasters like that, there is an increase, I believe, of 30% in the addictions, substance abuse and addiction that can be expected in the population.
That's from the NMHA,
right?
Which is and all of the mental health organizations, over 260,000 adult Louisianans could develop post-traumatic stress disorder. Roughly 120,000 Louisiana children will develop post-traumatic stress and related anxiety disorders. And only half that number of individuals continue to live and will seek treatment. But before Hurricane Katrina, The Federal Substance Abuse Mental Health and Service Administration estimated that one in five people in Louisiana could have any kind of deep emotional problems in 1 year. And they talked about approximately 650,000 adults and 245,000 children. As a result of Katrina, an additional 30% can be expected to develop symptoms and show signs as a direct result of their experience. Katrina directly impacted 500,000 people, suggesting that 200,000 could develop a need for treatment for substance abuse. We can estimate. So you don't think anybody is down there saying, all right, we better watch out now. Substance abuse, we're going to have to set up treatment programs for substance abuse. Or are they saying, no, we got to look good. We got to rebuild the homes. Let's tear down those 100-year-old homes and put up some skyscrapers so that people could have modern housing. Let's get them out. You know, that's what they're doing to make it look good. But is anybody considering that we can anticipate 200,000 people who are going to be having substance abuse problems that didn't have the problems before?
I doubt it.
As their only way of coping with the impact of this kind of disaster. This is Armand Demille with Roberta Maria Anti. If you talk about shame and you talk about shame and addiction, which is what we're talking about not only those who are down there, but those of us who are watching, who numbed ourselves by watching television. Television is one of the great addictions, and it's one of the ones that affect the chemistry of your brain. And your brain eventually just goes numb as you watch these flashing images in your head and you dissociate, you disconnect. What about violence? Is it possible that we become more violent the more we deny our own shame? Well, you know, psychopath, the ultimate killer, the one who has their primary symptom is they're shameless.
Right.
Without shame.
And guiltless.
That's it. Well, that's right. Exactly right.
Right. Well, you know, Armand, I think that a lot of the behaviors that we see in a government, and I'm not making names, could be classified and described as psychopathic, but because they involve, instead of one individual, a group of people, that diffuses the problem, and there's no longer any one individual that one can say, well, he's the one. And so we kind of feel powerless at dealing with psychopathy at that level. Because how do you even acknowledge it? How do you even declare it? How do you even admit that it's psychopathy? And yet, when you look at what's happening in a lot of different parts in the world, including what happened with Katrina, that is pure psychopathy in my view.
Well, you know, let's take for a moment the immediate reaction that took place. You know, in the Superdome, there were reports of raping and violence and murder and stealing. Now we have to ask the question, is this psychopathy? And I want to use, I know this may not be the best example. When a flower is dying, it will do anything to get water, to get what it needs in order to survive.
And to procreate.
And to procreate, right. We suspect, Roberta and I were speculating, that probably there were enormous number of children born on May 30th to people who probably had sex over that period. Now you're going to think, oh no, how could they have had sex? It was such a terrible environment. But, you know, that's the tendency. The natural instinct is when you get into the most disastrous trouble is to procreate. Yes. That's what God tells you to do, by God. I mean, you know, that's what your body and nature tells you to do. It tells you get together and at least have offspring because you may die.
Yes, and also there is something to be said for the fact that the nervous system in an emergency like that, in a life-threatening situation, kind of disengages with the rational activity and goes to the survival mode. And in the survival mode, a lot of the instinctual, self-protective and self-asserting behaviors come out. And that's just what happened when people are threatened. Either you cower and you hide because you are under attack, or if you are in a situation where you think you might die, what may come out of you is this surge of vitality that drives you into behaviors that you normally would not even think of. And yet, there you are, you know, fighting for your life and feeling sexy in the midst of disaster, because that's your survival instinct that's kicking in. So, you know, I don't understand how we could classify that as abnormal behavior or necessarily as, you know, lacking morals or whatever it is that it's described as. I think it's just people trying to survive and trying to feel alive.
Well, you know, I mean, not even trying to, but it's the only alternative to death. But, you know, one of the things that they're planning, when they're planning psychiatric services and social services for the people who suffered through this, they are planning to give them medications.
Of course.
And they are planning to give them medications to help them get through it. But what they're not planning to do is to have groups where they get a chance to talk about what they did during this time to survive and what it felt like. And some of, even if we had them, I mean, if you and I, Roberta, were working with these people, we would get them to express their feelings and say, what did you go through? What did you do? What do you feel inside? And to release those feelings, but those feelings are going to get swallowed, and those feelings are going to just go buried inside.
Yeah, they're going to go back in.
And because they're buried, they are going to result in a deeper depression.
Right.
But again, you know, the people who are going to come along, who are going to help out, are trying to dress up the situation and say, here's what we see now. Here's how we're going to help it. We're going to make it look good. We're going to get them more clothing. We're going to paint their houses. We're going to, you know, fix it up. We're going to make it, but let's not think about the future. Let's not think about the future course. And we'll medicate them.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll do exactly to them what the, what was going to happen to them anyway, you know,
and see how good we look and see how good we are.
Try to, but it's not working this time. Something's happening around this anniversary that I've never seen before. I know September 11th anniversary is coming up. That's one kind of reminder. But in this, we have one of the ultimate moments of human disregard for a group of people. And if you looked real close, and I have, you see things that are just beyond humanity. I mean, this is as bad as anything, to ignore this pain and suffering. It's clearly what happens. And when we get back, I'm going to ask Roberta to report to us on some of what she's seen in Europe happening to us, the people, the Americans, who are on the other side of public opinion.
Are you sure you want to hear it?
Yes, I certainly do, Roberta, because I know how difficult it is. I hear from so many people from over in Europe and Asia who tell us what's happening. And it's going to be a painful happening. So when we get back from our break, we're going to go into that and talk about that, and then we're going to talk about the treatment and the help for the children of Katrina and how we see things that may be a little different than what the press is reporting. This is Armand DeMille with Roberta Maria Atti with you at The Positive Mind. I'm going to not just end this today. I'm going to continue on with this again tomorrow. I may even take your calls tomorrow to hear some of your feelings about it. But we're talking about the effects of Hurricane Katrina and some of the psychological factors that we consider may not be absolutely considered. We'll be back with you in a couple of minutes. Thank you.
Are we really happy here with this lonely game we play? Looking for words to say. Searching but not finding understanding anywhere. Lost in a masquerade. Both afraid to say we're just too far away from being close together from the start. We tried to talk it over, but the words got in the way. We're lost inside this lonely game we play. Hearts are weeping, disappear every time I see your eyes.
Yeah, it's more appropriate than one would imagine. That's George Benson, and I'm just using it as a bridge to talk with you. This is Armand DeMille with Roberta Maria Atti. We're talking about Katrina and the effects of Katrina on the whole idea of the anniversary of Katrina, on the 1 year after Katrina date, and what's happened. And more stuff has happened over the last day. My friends, pay attention. Pay attention to what's coming out. There are things coming out now that have never come out before. There are things you will see, if you could tolerate it, that we've never known. And all of the judgments that you were guided to have at the beginning, looking down and saying, oh, those people, you know, they're just poor, or they're just uneducated, or they're just, you know, there's something wrong with them, or they like jazz. You know, how could they be decent? And so when we watch them, and we watch them fall apart, and we watch them and they're screaming out, it's almost like we're looking at them and saying, oh, they must be drunk screaming like that for help, because they always scream for help. Whatever you did in your mind to put it in a place where it didn't touch your heart, now you're less defended. Now go back and look and see some of the film coverage and see some of what's happened out there and watch. Watch how easy it is, because, my friends, it really pays to crack your heart open. It pays not to go numb. Feel the pain of it, because the pain is what we are and what we're doing and what we're a part of. And this is the only thing that will lead you free enough to be an active participant in the reshaping of our world. Because right now it's going downhill. I want to give you an example of some of the solutions. Here's managing traumatic stress, the hurricanes and children. And I'm going to read you a recipe that Roberta unearthed for how they intend to help children. Here it is. Managing traumatic stress, the hurricanes and children. The intense anxiety and fear that followed the Katrina disaster will be especially troubling for surviving children, especially if the children were direct victims of the disaster or were separated from their families. Some may regress and demonstrate younger behaviors such as thumb-sucking and bedwetting, which I've seen is a lot of reporting of that. Children may be more prone to nightmares and fear of sleeping alone. Performance in school, when schools are available, will suffer, and other changes in behavior patterns may include throwing tantrums or withdrawing and becoming more solitary. So these are the things that are intended to help. This is the recipe. So when we get these children back, here's the recipe that government mental health organizations are saying that you should do.
Well, Well, the suggestions are as follows. Spend more time with the children and let them be more dependent on you during the months that follow the trauma.
Now, just imagine. Imagine you're back in New Orleans, if you're back in New Orleans, or you're settling in some new place, and you're trying to reestablish your life. Here is a mental health agency telling you, spend more time with your children.
Right.
Let them become more dependent on you, you know?
When you're not rebuilding your roof or...
Or trying to get some money to feed your children, right?
Trying to get a job.
Yeah, right. Number two.
Provide play experiences to help relieve the tension.
Go outside and play with one of the dead bodies. You know. I don't
want
to be macabre, but it's like,
right,
what play experiences for the children are going to be available? Yes, it would be wonderful if you could remember to do it.
Yes, it sounds like, it assumes like those, like we have resources that are far from coming. Be available and encourage older children to ask questions they may have, as well as sharing their thoughts and feelings with you and with one another.
And how difficult is it to ask your children, to have your children ask you the question like, why didn't they help us?
Right. Yeah.
What answer would you have, my friend? It also says keep regular schedules for activities such as eating, playing, and going to bed to restore a sense of security and normalcy.
You know,
what bed?
It's almost insulting.
It's insulting.
We're talking to people who don't have beds and who have probably been sleeping in camps or the equivalent in shelters. And
there is no regular life.
Provide safe opportunities for children to help others.
And this means that you should help your child give a hand to others, which is a wonderful thought. I mean, but, you know, how are you going to try to feel safe enough to get your child out of your sight? One of the things that happened to most parents is the fear of losing their children, as many did. There are a certain number of children who have no parents. There are babies out there who they can't find parents for. There are parents who died. And there are babies out there with no parents. And parents knew desperately the one thing you do is you hold on to your child. You make sure you've got your hand wrapped around your child at all time. No, I'll let my child now go out and help the other kids. I'll encourage them to do it. No, because that would mean double work for you.
You know, Armand, it sounds like these are suggestions given as a routine must do that, you know, an agency has the responsibility of writing these things and making them available on the internet just because they have to say that they did so. But these are people who were far from the place of the disaster, or else they themselves would realize that these suggestions are useless. Reduce the number of times that children see the trauma on the news. Well, sometimes children...
Well, they don't have to see it on the news, you know. You could look right around the corner.
Exactly.
How could you reduce... Don't look at that. Right? Don't look over there. Don't look where your school used to be.
Oh, boy. Yes. It's really... if this is the best we can come up with, no wonder we feel ashamed, Armand.
If children have continual and aggressive emotional outbursts, seek help from a professional who could prescribe a medication that will help control these outrageous behaviors.
Give them a bit of Valium and all will be well.
This is Armand DeMille with you at The Positive Mind with Roberta Maria Atti. I want to talk about something painful to my heart. I want to talk about what happened to us because I remember in...
Well, when I was growing up in Italy, America was the big dream. Every child I knew, including myself, had a dream of coming to America. I remember there was a chewing gum called Brooklyn. And on the gum, on the package, there was a drawing of the bridge. And boy, I dreamt of that Brooklyn bridge and the day I would step on it, like it was... You know, when Dorothy thinks of the land beyond the rainbow, something like that.
Did you ever do it?
Oh, yes. Yes, I did. And it was great. It was great. Oh, my God. That bridge was in my dreams ever since I was a very young child. Yes.
So now this is a dream, and of course, all through the early days, which were, I guess, in the 70s, right? When you were a child. No,
yes.
You were in the 60s when you were a child.
My father used to tell me of when he was starving as a young man, and the Americans showed up with cigarettes, coffee, and chocolate. And to him, he had this adoration for American people that you could see came from the feeling that they saved his life. Not only that, but they gave him cigarettes during the war. Mm-hmm. I mean, that was like unthinkable. So I grew up with this image of American people being the givers, generous endlessly, and endlessly resourceful, and America being the land of dreams where everyone would be free and respected and cared for. As I speak, I get choked up.
How many people?
Makes me sad. Well,
you know, how many people? I'm thinking about India, and I'm thinking about all the other countries in the world that felt the very same way.
Right.
And then it started to turn, Roberta.
Yes.
What was the turning point in Europe for the regard for America?
Well, it started to change after the Vietnam era because, you know, that was the first enormous failure of the American system, and the American image suffered greatly. But things really became disastrous after the 2001. I mean, after 9/11, there was a...
Go back a second.
Okay.
Go back a second. The Vietnam War.
That was the beginning.
That was the beginning. Now, this is a beginning where we started getting disregarded by many countries who started looking at us and saying, what are you doing there, fellas? Right?
Right.
And the fact that we, in effect, lost the war and had to hightail out of there kind of took away our invincibility at the same time. But that
right.
wasn't enough. There was still 70s and 80s between
mm-hmm.
London and London being, you know, the place where you could have an almost American experience.
Sure.
Right? And
yes.
then United States, and it was still everybody wanted to be, and everybody wore guess jeans and,
oh,
you
yes.
know,
everything was
U.S.
airy
clothing. And then came 9/11. No, and then it started going downhill with the presidents, the sequence of presidents, right?
Well, the first one that was not well-liked in Europe was Reagan. He was seen as a bit of a joker and not really taken seriously. But then with the Bush era, things just kept getting worse and worse, and the image of America went from being the land of dreams and opportunity to the land of bullies and, liars. And really, bullies is the image.
So kind of going backwards just a little bit, we've got Vietnam, and then we have Johnson, but then we have Ford,
mm-hmm.
you know, and it begins to crack right around then.
It's
you
really
know,
with Reagan that it started
And then with
down,
Reagan,
no?
it started going downhill, yeah. and then came the Bushes, and then came, you know, this whole political thing after the
Well, there was a moment of resurgence around 9/11 where
there was a big resurgence.
All the world felt empathic, and America had a moment of glory there, unfortunately, through unfortunate circumstances, but everyone felt, you know, that we deserved some empathy and some support. But then, with the invasion of Afghanistan, that ended right there, because I remember I went to Italy shortly after Afghanistan was invaded, and I remember people asking me, how could it be that the United States is going into a country as poor as Afghanistan and destroying the very little that's left after Soviet invasion and occupation? What are they doing there? Why are they doing this? It's incomprehensible. It seems like killing a fly with a nuclear bomb. What's the advantage of this? It can only be that there is a hidden agenda here that the United States is not sharing with the rest of the world.
Now, the disdain that people felt at that time was not just for America, but also Britain, who is one of our Great Britain, which was one
right,
of our supporters,
allies,
started
right.
getting some of the negative.
Sure.
Feedback.
It's all seen as the same group of people who are greedy and power hungry and care nothing about destroying human lives in pursuit of wealth and power, basically.
But there was enough rebellion in our country and in England. There was enough people fighting back and saying no, protesting, huge protests. But as it persisted and persisted more and more, I'm sure, you know, that as we went into Iraq, the people must have, you know, the people around the world must have looked at us and felt pity for us. Didn't they feel pity?
No, they felt contempt, Armand, because I believe the protest is not, it doesn't get to Italian people. The knowledge of the protesters doesn't get there. So in Italy, people don't know about the protesting, you know, people who ask for peace. They only know about what America is doing globally, just through the invasions and the power that it's showing, but we don't hear in Italy about the protesters. So all the image that comes out is the image of the, I hesitate to use the words that I would use, but they don't feel any pity for us, Armand. Unfortunately, they feel pure extreme contempt for Americans. And when I go to Italy, I almost feel ashamed, even though I'm not American, and even though I'm a resident, I'm not a citizen, but because I live here, in part, I feel the same shame. People come up to me and ask me, Roberta, how could it be that in Katrina, your government didn't do anything? How could it be? Can you tell us what happened? Can you explain it to us? And of course I can't. How could I explain it? I can't explain it to myself. But they stop me to ask me, is it true? Is it real? How could it be? How could it be that a government doesn't rescue all these people, leaves them behind as if they were nothing? How can it be?
Something happened to the soul of many people. Something happened. You know, we could look at, we look at Shiites, we look at Muslims killing each other, and we look at it with an eye that has a lack of feeling to it. We go, oh boy, they blew up a mosque. Oh boy, you know, you blew up. And there's very little, except for the Muslims amongst us, who would really have much feeling about it, except, oh yeah, well, that's the way they are, those guys who wear those things, turbans on their heads. They blow each other up, and that's the kind of disregard they have for each other's lives. And then we hear about suicide bombers and none of that. You know, we could even listen to England and Ireland having all kinds of brutal wars and not feel anything about it unless you identify. Then suddenly if a suicide bomber walks into something that you consider your culture, then you say, we are justified in killing.
Mm-hmm.
Back. Suddenly we could look at all the death of all the people in India. Wasn't there, remember the thing that happened in France when so many people died?
Oh, the heat wave.
The heat wave that killed so many.
Mm-hmm.
In a way, Americans looked at it and said, man, you see those French people?
Mm-hmm.
It's almost like they got what they deserved.
Right.
Where was the feeling? Where was it?
Right.
So for once in life, for once, however it happened, during 2001, a whole group of the world turned to us and said, oh, we're so sorry, regardless of the cause, we're so sorry that 1,000 people died in this trauma. We're so sorry. We have pity for you.
Right.
We have more than pity. We show our support. We show our love. America, we forgive you.
Yes.
We forgive you. We embrace you. It was at that moment that there was this gigantic chance
mm-hmm.
for us to become the humans again.
Yeah.
You know? And instead, between the election and between what happened right before it and between the world's knowledge of it, and then with the invasion of Afghanistan and Iraq, the world looked at us and they said, you're just powerless. But yet, even when Katrina happened, tears were shed all over the globe. I got letters from everywhere, Roberta. Yes. I got it from many of our listeners who are in different parts of the world, sent us back and said, it's a horror. It's terrible. You know, what do we do? Who do we send stuff to? How can we help?
Yes, it's almost like people outside of the U.S. had more feelings than people in the U.S., which, you know, it's what we're talking about today, that
we've gone numb.
Right. The shame has numbed us. Because I think going through that shame is so painful. It requires an awareness of certain things that are so painful for us to look at that we would rather not feel anything than to feel that pain. And yet, as you said before, perhaps that's what's required at this time.
Well, what might be required, if you're somebody who tends to feel the pain at such a level that in some way it renders you powerless completely and you can't do your job, we're not talking directly to you. I'm talking to the rest of you. The rest of you who feel so little that you've turned off the emotion. Here's what I'm suggesting. I'm suggesting that if you want to be a part of a growing world and you want to be a part of correcting this, let yourself feel the pain. Not those of you who feel the pain all the time. You could afford to shut it off. But those of you who have not shed your tears, let yourself shed your tears. Because unless you do it, you're going to wind up numb. And if you've got a therapist and you talk to your therapist and your therapist doesn't encourage you to go into those feelings and try to go through them, instead they logic you out of them because that's what the therapist might have done. Find another therapist. Mm-hmm. Go into your heart, my friends. Mm-hmm. Find somebody you love and hold their hand and look at the pictures and look at the thing that there's a New Yorker magazine has this incredible photograph of a bed. In the middle of it, you know the one I'm talking about. And there's just a photograph of a bed after Katrina, and it just...
It's a bedroom, actually, with the bed completely destroyed. Yeah.
Let yourself feel it, my friends, because that'll keep you a part of this growing world, the part of the world that will help correct this numbness that we've kind of let ourselves fall into.
Yeah.
This is Armand DeMille with Roberta Maria Atti. I'm going to be back with you tomorrow at 1 p.m. with a little more about mental health and Hurricane Katrina. Roberta Maria Atti, if people want to reach you, they could reach you at?
My website, which is www.creativehealthsolutions.org.
And if you want a replay of today's program, or if you want to mail it to somebody, which is possible through the good graces of Tom Gerby, you can go to www.thepositivemind.com. I will be back with you tomorrow at 1 p.m., my friends. Until then, be well.
Wade in the water, wade in the water, children, wade in the water. God's gonna trouble the water. God's gonna trouble the water.